Hello, everybody, and welcome to today's audio conference training on documentation, confidentiality, and record keeping in supervised visitation centers offered by the Office on Violence Against Women in partnership with Praxis International. So nice to be with you all again today. My name is Beth McNamara, and I'm the program manager with Praxis International, the Technical Assistance on Supervised Visitation and Safe Exchange Program. Today is the first session of our three-part series. We will be recording this training session, and we'll make the recording available via our online streaming on our website, praxisinternational.org, at the completion of the entire series. In addition to the audio recording that we'll post, we will also post any additional materials that are mentioned on this call today or throughout the series on our website, so you can take a peek at that if you're looking for additional resources that we've talked about. You'll also find on our website the materials for today's session. Those of you, when you registered for the session, were emailed those materials as an attachment with your registration confirmation and the call-in number. But they are also on our website, just in case you want to quickly download those if you have access to a computer. We have everyone's lines muted today, with the exception of those of us who will be talking the majority of the time. Mostly not me, but our trainer today, and our we do have the ability to have you join the call anytime that you want by pushing the number one, and then Carrie, who is our operator, can get you in the question queue, and she can let me know when there are folks lined up in the question queue, and we can take breaks as often as you have questions. You can also email me at any time if that's a more comfortable way to offer your questions, your comments, your discussion points. So feel free to email me at beth@praxisinternational.org, and I can pop those questions into you and for you. But like I said, we will try to take a few breaks for intentional time for questions, but please feel free to jump in the question queue as soon as you have a question, and that way there isn't that much of a delay. Just a regular disclaimer, I just wanted to remind folks that this training is presented by Praxis International, and while we're supported as an OVW, by OVW as a technical assistance provider for this grant program, and we try very hard to stay in line with OVW and the other technical assistance providers, we are not speaking for them. So the points of view presented on this call are those of the speakers and or Praxis and do not necessarily represent OVW. Today's session is called Documentation Dilemmas. And as we know, all of you know very well probably, that documentation and supervised visitation can be very complicated and fraught with risks and safety to the safety of victims and their children. And it's an ongoing challenge for visitation centers. So I'm so glad that you've joined us today. We have the honor of saying that we have two amazing women with us today. Jane Sadusky is our trainer, and she's been working to end violence against women for the past 30 years. She's been working with the Supervised Visitation Grant Program Initiative since 2002, and documentation and the dilemmas that accompany it are among the many areas of exploration that Jane has done in the supervised visitation field. So we're very happy to have Jane with us today. And we also have Tracy Parker. And Tracy has graciously offered to be on our call today to offer a practice perspective as we move through our training call today. And for those of you who have had the opportunity to meet Tracy, you know how much knowledge and passion and how much really smart thinking Tracy has and carries with her around this work. So we're very pleased that she's with us today. Tracy is a program coordinator at a site in Kent, Washington. And she's been the program coordinator since the center opened in 2005. We were just doing a little reminiscing, and it doesn't seem possible that it's been that long. And then we also think, gosh, it just feels like a blink of an eye, and then it seems like 100 years ago that you opened your doors. So She has had a wealth of experience in both planning before the center opened and then as she moved through that process of providing services. So thank you to both Tracy and Jane. And I am going to turn the baton over to Jane now, and she's going to take away our training for today.
Thank you, Beth. And hello and welcome to everyone this afternoon that's listening in to this call. And it's really a delight also to have Tracy be able to join us and provide, I've been calling her our practice example, working with the demonstration initiative sites, which included Kent and Chicago and Michigan and the Bay Area of California, was this amazing experience. And we spent a lot of time chewing over these questions around documentation and all of its intricacies and aspects. So a good share of what we provide this afternoon will be drawing very much on that experience. I wanted to start with a bit of an example, though, kind of a real life, this is what documentation can look like, to introduce the subject and to raise some of the questions that we'll look a little more closely at. Now, many of you have this in the handout, but I thought I'd do a little bit of radio theater and very quickly read the main portion of this letter. And you think of reports like this. This is a report to the court from any place visitation center, coming across judges and court official desks day after day. And one of the experiences I had in Kent was sitting in on the protection order court for a day or two. And in King County, they videotape those protection order and also family court motions. So one day I sat in and I got to kind of watch that from the perspective of a petitioner sitting in the courtroom. Well, then later I got the videotape from those same sessions. And it was amazing because I got to kind of watch it from the perspective of the bench more than a petitioner sitting in the audience. And one of the things that struck me was the court dealing with these mountains of paper. Some of the family court motions, there would be 6, 10, 12 inches of paper in front of a judge or a court official who's, you can tell, is really struggling to make a decision and make a decision that is going to be protective and going to be safe, but is struggling very much with even finding the information that might be useful. So part of that is this piece of documentation is thinking about, well, what information is carried to the court, to the user of this documentation, and is it related to the safety and the protection and the concern that the court has and that we all have for people's safety? So let's start with this example. And this is a report to the court involving Amanda Moore, who is the petitioner and the custodial parent, Joe Brown, who's the respondent and the visiting parent. And there are two children. Joe Jr. is 6 years old, and his sister Jill is 4 years old. Date visitation started, February 3rd, 2004. So this report is coming approximately 4 months later. There have been 15 visits. The visits were scheduled for 1 hour every week. Punctuality. Mom did not show up for the first scheduled visit. When the center called her, she expressed she forgot about the visit and was apologetic. On May 6th, Mom's friend dropped the children off 10 minutes late. On June 6th, Mom was 5 minutes late for visitation. On February 17th, Dad was 15 minutes late for visitation. He expressed that his lawyer advised him to start visits on March 1st. However, he wanted to see his children and arrived late to the visit. On April 15, Dad called and said he would be 10 minutes late because he was picking up his son, Charles, to visit with Joe Jr. and Jill. Compliance. Dad complied with all rules of visitation. However, Mom was advised on May 13 that her friend, Mr. Smith, was not to drop the children off for visitation in light of the restraining order against Mr. Smith. On May 20, Dad called police to the center and explained the restraining order. The police asked for the May 13th letter to be faxed to them, and the center faxed the letter the same day to Officer Pine's attention. Observation. Mr. Brown interacts with his children, playing board games and outside play. Jill enjoys putting her head on Dad's shoulder and hugging him as Dad walks around holding her during the visits. Dad brought his son, Charles, to 6 visits, and Joe Jr. and Jill were happy to see him and enjoyed playing with him. Dad was very loving, caring, and attentive to all his children during supervised visits. Also, Mr. Brown always displayed a positive attitude during his weekly visits with his children. Now I want to turn to Tracy and ask Tracy, you've now been working with the center for 5 years. What kind of questions does this particular example of documentation raise for you?
Well, it's painting a very cheery picture, kind of on behalf of the dad. So it's not really. I would want to know what was happening for me. Like how there's a couple of places where there's gaps in information, particularly where it's going over the punctuality piece and it's talking about he was not supposed to start till 3:01, and for some reason they started earlier, and she was late all those times before then. So what's that about? Was there something that was supposed to be happening and some reason she couldn't get there on time during that? I'd also want to know more about this restraining order and why is he calling the police to the center, and what the restraining order is against her friend, and what that has to do with the visitation and the kids getting to the center. It also doesn't tell me anything about why they got there. I don't have any sense of why they were referred. Did they come through protection order process? Did they come through a custody action? I don't know what we're watching for in this scenario.
Well, here's a little bit of what the report omitted, and I think it speaks to some of the points that you've made about gaps in information and exactly why is this family here and what's going on. And one of the things it doesn't note was that the reason for supervised visitation. And in this case, Mr. Brown had been arrested on domestic violence-related charges 4 times in the 6 months prior to the visitation order. One arrest was for assaulting the custodial parent, Amanda Moore, as well as a burglary of her residence. And 3 of the arrests were for violations of a restraining order. As a result of this, he was on probation. So one piece that's not there is this connection with the reason for the visitation. And particularly here, you have a pattern of escalating violence and repeated violations of restraining orders, both of which signal and should put everyone on alert that this may be a far more risky situation than we might have assumed. So there's that piece of the story that's not here. And actually this example, you know, the names have been changed but the form and the content and the information itself is an actual report that came out of an analysis of a center's records and documentation. When you look at other material, you find that doesn't support the statement that Dad complied with all the rules. In fact, he had a pattern of arriving early and kind of parking in ways so he could monitor and see when the children arrived and with whom. And he's also been bringing his older son, who's not authorized to visit, either via the court order or via permission from the mother. So there's a bit of the center kind of setting aside some of its rules in this case. Another piece of the bigger picture that's not evident here is you have a parent who's seems to be trying to engage the center to help reinforce a measure of control over the children's mother. So he's repeatedly making his presence known. He's sending a message that he knows who is coming and going and monitoring those activities. He tries to draw the police in well, in as well around the restraining order, which the center never does any independent verification of. There's not a copy in the file. There's no indication that there's been a verification that there's any prohibition to prevent this Mr. Smith from bringing the children. And oftentimes, mothers who are being battered very much have an interest in, wherever possible, having someone else bring children to the center. And then finally, there's this context piece missing to provide a disclaimer of sorts that the behavior that's described has occurred in this very artificial, supervised setting and isn't necessarily to infer or mean that this kind of behavior would continue in an unsupervised setting. So we have this very small, quick example of one piece of documentation that's raising many questions about how is this linked to this larger purpose of safety and protection and equal regard for safety. One of the things that we're presenting here today, and I know that we're all always eager to get the list of, if you do exactly this, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you'll be able to put in place a documentation system that will work seamlessly and relatively headache-free. Unfortunately, that certainly wasn't the experience of the demonstration sites. And in actual practice, to provide something that's more dynamic and that we keep coming back to make sure it's meeting the purposes that we want it to, we're instead providing kind of foundations. Now, we are going to wrap up with some more specific practice tips. So for those of you who are going, well, but I really want to know what I should do and how to do it, there'll be some things to think about there. But we're going to focus first on this idea of some foundations for thinking about documentation. If you're one of the planning grantees and you're in the midst of setting this up, things that can be helpful, kind of guidelines for thinking about how to do that. For centers that are operating, it's a way to kind of step back and say, well, what do we have going here? And how does it rest or not rest on these foundations? So before we get into that, though, I want to also kind of switch back to Tracy here and start by getting a sense of documentation is challenging, but what's been the most challenging to your center in establishing its documentation practices?
That's
kind of a loaded question, isn't it?
Because I think just getting over our own fear of how information might be used or misused, and so getting really clear around why we're documenting, what is the purpose of our documentation, and so how are we going to say things in a way that is as objective as we can be and still accounting for the battering. So, you know, like if we're really careful here. We've worked on this really hard like everybody has, but nothing comes out of this center without full staff discussion and engagement. So which that takes time. We have to talk these things out. We look at what's the point of this. Are we just angry at this family right now? Are we documenting something just because we just want to get them? Or are we documenting because we're trying to demonstrate that the battering is still happening and how to best do that in the way that the court or anybody else could understand it? So trying to kind of educate through our documentation is really hard. Because if we just write something like on this example that you read, you know, we would just never address punctuality like that. It would never, for instance, we would never have anything that said, Mr. Smith is bringing the children. The children got to the center. It doesn't matter how they got there to the other party. So we just have to think through all that. How can any of this stuff be used against the victim parent? When we're getting a sense of something's off, we have to figure out a way to address that in our documentation that makes sense and doesn't sound like we're just kind of exaggerating and crazy. So, yeah, it's just all challenging. So I'd say if it had to be the most difficult, it is that trying to stay objective and paint the picture of battering where we need to. Also separating out parenting stuff from battering.
And why have you paid attention to that?
We're not here for parenting. We're here because there's a safety risk for the adult as well as the children. And so parenting can look great in a visit here. It has nothing to do with anything. So really, like our documentation here, the visit documentations are pretty benign. They're just a list of whether or not we intervened. There might be some expansion on something if we had to really talk to somebody after the visit about some specific things. But our documentation is more about the stuff that's happening in between the visits. How is the schedule being used to continue battering? What's happening if we can't get the survivor to come in? We need to figure out how to talk to her in a way that makes sense, that explains the possible consequences of not coming in, and still let her know that that's, you know, we're not here to enforce orders. We're here to keep everybody safe. And so we're just kind of always checking back with each other around that. That's our goal. The reason families come here is because there's a history of domestic violence. And so that always, we have to keep that at the forefront. We're not doing reunification or child welfare or anything like that.
Which, given that that's where so much of supervised visitation started in that arena, and there's still a big, to a big degree, and in some centers they're doing both that more historical child welfare kind of supervised visitation, which carries more attention to parenting, and now all of a sudden doing more supervised visitation that's attending to safety and the context of battering and domestic violence. I think you made a really good point. That's where things can get kind of muddled up, because if we come with that one set of assumptions that it is about whether this person can communicate with their child and spend time with them, and we need to make sure that day-to-day parenting is safe, that's one direction. But if it's to be paying attention to equal regard for safety in the context of domestic violence, then that's a different lens within
right.
which to be looking at things and developing. One thing that I made myself a little note here is you were talking, because I think this might be one of our first practice tips that we should take note of, which is I really heard that staff communication and cohesion is central to sound documentation.
Yes. For us, we're really clear, even on everything that goes out, it says right on it, all documentation is by staff consensus, that it is not one person's opinion. So it never says, the visit monitor said that he did this. It's that the staff, we all pay attention when something's going on. The staff, you know, there were three staff persons present when this was happening. So everything that we're discussing, we'll discuss you know, we're concerned about the arrival patterns. Like, for instance, if you're saying in the background of this case he was parking somewhere odd, that would be a staff discussion, and it would be so noted as a staff concern about potential stalking behaviors. What's going on? How did he know about Mr. Smith? So it gives us kind of the room to say, here's what we're concerned about. We may be incorrect, but this is what's coming up for us as we're serving this family.
So it's not a staff member observing a visit, checking off things on a form, filing that away, and then never having any discussion
right.
or review about what information has now gone into what becomes the part of the official story
right.
of this family's experience.
And even our observation form, our it's a form that we have that's a checklist, and it's only interventions. It's not anything other than that. Even that has a little blurb written in it to remind the staff that we're intervening, we're documenting battering. We're not documenting, like we might intervene for something because it's going kind of awry a little bit, or it might be something benign, but we think we should intervene. But if it's not something that is significant to, if it doesn't look like it could be battering it, then we think about that before we. So, yeah, it's not just this kind of make your checklist and put it away. We discuss it. We have, you know, weekly consults, and we discuss every family we're serving and where they're at, how things are going, and any ongoing safety or scheduling problems.
The whole discussion of documentation, it's so intertwined with confidentiality and information sharing, and we're going to try to not get into those two aspects particularly, because those are also part of this series of audio conference trainings. So that would probably be another practice tip, is that it would be helpful if you heard all three in the series and then brought all of that together in thinking about documentation, which certainly begins with, I think it's easy to think of documentation being the visits, the observations, but it really begins with that very first contact and orientation and looking at what are we asking from people, how are we gathering information, where and how do we do that, how do we keep it, is there information that needs to be inaccessible to anything other than a subpoena, all of those kinds of questions kind of go in the mix there. And certainly there's a continuum of approaches to documentation. And this was another piece that was very striking in working with across the four demonstration sites. There were about 12 different centers coming from very different backgrounds, and a continuum of approaches from documenting almost very sparingly, much as Tracy's been describing, to documenting what I call almost every hiccup, which is a very kind of detailed, labor-intensive record of mostly parent-child interactions. Now, that's not to say they all ended up there, but certainly that's where a lot of centers started, and based on more recent experience, I would say then still quite a few that are have made a decision to stay on that end of the continuum that's very intensive documentation. And any point on that continuum can be problematic, particularly if you're not starting with that lens of safety, that kind of question about who's doing what to whom and with what impact and consequence for their safety and well-being. I think, Beth, before we start talking more about these foundations, this would be a good time to check in and see if there's any questions out there.
Okay, so I don't have anyone in the question queue. But to remind you that you can email me, Beth, B-E-T-H, at praxisinternational.org, and I would be happy to insert your question or your comment, or push in the number 1, and Carrie, who is the operator, can get in the question queue, and I'll let Jane know when you're popped in there. All right?
Yeah. Okay, and we'll take another break a bit later to see if we have any additional questions. So we've laid out these 7 key foundations as things to think about in pulling together documentation. And I'm going to go through them. There's a couple of them that we're going to talk about in a little more detail, but I want to make sure that we can give this overview and then also get into some of the practice considerations as well. At one level, I think these foundations are also practice considerations because there's not necessarily this fine, distinct, bright line between setting a foundation for a policy and the way it's implemented in practice. So first on this list, and this ties very much back to the guiding principles, is to build documentation on an equal regard for safety. And that means really understanding battering and understanding distinctions between battering and other forms of domestic violence. We tend to throw everything in that big bucket labeled domestic violence, but if there's one thing that has become so very clear in the 30-some years of current work on this issue is that it's not all the same. And that's a piece of laying the foundation is understanding that distinction, which is another whole series of audio conference trainings. But one of the things I'll say to keep an eye out for, because we've just finished this at Praxis, is something called the Blueprint for Safety. And the St. Paul Blueprint for Safety is a very sweeping, comprehensive laying out of an interagency approach to responding, in this case, to domestic violence criminal cases. But one piece of that I think is going to also be very useful for supervised visitation centers once it is available on the web is a practitioner's guide to risk and safety in domestic violence cases. And it's a nice kind of desk card summation tied to research about what we know right now about what ramps up risk for danger and lethality and what are some of the things that should get us all very concerned if someone is coming through our doors and this is going on for them. So there are a variety of tools and many, many sources of information around building that better understanding of battering and equal regard for safety. So that would be foundation 1. A second foundation that we defined was, and this will be a bit applies more to centers that are kind of up and running. I will say that for development grantees, there are ways to also provide some of this experience, perhaps through some of the technical assistance that's available. But it's to begin with a guided reading of the center's files. And that's gathering up a sample of the case files and doing a very specific and deliberate reading and analysis of them. And Tracy, I know we did this in Kent. In fact, I can still picture sitting in your conference room with those files and with a variety of people kind of reading through them and seeing what we could glean from them. So can you talk a bit more about how you used that and what you got from it?
Well, the first thing I learned is it's really hard to redact things, so the less places I put names and identifiers, the better. So that changed a lot in how we document. For the longest time, we referred to them as CP or VP, custodial parent versus visiting parent, all throughout our documentation. And now we've switched that to mother, and father, because that's how the court, we realize that's what they read in the court from family court service assessments. They refer to them as mother or father, so we thought it would be easier for everybody involved if that's what it said. But going through those and realizing, you know, we could look at something. I think we've been always pretty good about identifying, you know, who needs protection in what we write. But I think we've learned so much about just digging in and really seeing how we're writing. For instance, I did things by hand because I have this huge aversion to putting anything about clients on the computer. But I realized nobody's going to read that. If I really want them to read it, it needs to be clear and readable. And I learned that going through
files. Are you saying that your handwriting was not the best?
No, it's not. And also I learned that when I went and was part of an audit for a whole different audit, wasn't us, but I was on the team, I didn't want to look at the ones that were handwritten. I thought, and my staff just really gave me a hard time about that because they were telling me that for years before I caved. But and then just kind of looking at, we ended up adding an intake summary into the file that where I, after I do the intakes, I kind of pull what both parties told me. If they both told me something, I pull that in. Like, so it might say, this, our goal on this up front was that if the court gets the file, there's a page right there at the very beginning that reminds the court why they got ordered to supervise visitation. So it says, you know, there's a protection order or there's a criminal no contact order and a hearing pending or something. It'll say, ordered to safe havens via protection order court, protection order process, protection order filed after incident where father allegedly strangled mother, DV charges pending. So it says that right there, or it might say they've been, there's if it's a visiting mother but she's the battered woman, it will say that father has a history of domestic violence, there's been 3 protection orders in the past. So it'll remind folks that the reason they're here is the DV. And then we've then started adding in, after we did that, started adding in the whole intake process. So from the very first, that's in this intake summary, from the very first time they call us, the battering starts. The way they use us is battering. We become part of it instantly. So now we write, you know, she contacted us on March 3rd. First contact from him was not till June 7th. We tried to call her. At that point, her number was no longer active. We're waiting for her to call back. So we're documenting if he kind of put it, or if he's calling us daily and trying to get letters saying she's not contacting us, or it says how long or difficult it was to get the first visit started because he wouldn't accept any appointments that we offered. So now that's all included on this kind of upfront piece before you get any further in the file. And I think that's helped us a lot, because then even when staff comes in and they want to just take a quick look at the family to remember what's going on, that's right there, right up front. And then they'll go back and look deeper if they need more information. So I learned a lot from just really digging through and seeing, if I had to show these to people that were looking for information, what would they see? What would they know?
Jane?
Yeah?
We have a question in the queue.
Okay.
Carrie, would you mind putting that through?
So our question comes from Lona Mayfield. Lona, your line is open.
Hi, I'm working over here at CASA, and we have a question. Specifically, what should be documented during a supervised parenting time?
Are you, Jane, do you want me to try that?
Well, why don't you start, Tracy, by kind of speaking from the perspective of your center.
Yeah, because I don't know that there's a what should be documented. I think it for us, it's we're documenting if we had to intervene and during the actual visit. And then our other documentation is about between visits, like what's the communication been? What have been the problems we've been having? You know, if somebody calls me an asshole and hangs the phone up, that's going in the file. if that's a consistent behavior. Now, we might not document that if that was just one time somebody went off and it doesn't feel like an ongoing tactic or a way of abusing us or anything like that. So we're always trying to think about what is the purpose of what we're writing. If we documented we had to intervene four times because, you know, the visiting parent continued to ask the child if what church they're going to or where, you know, or despite being redirected, continued with the same stuff, that would be documented and it would say how many times we documented. But we're minimalists. We're not putting a whole lot. We might put a little reminder in there, you know, asking about church so that we can talk to him later about that particular thing. But then it would be more of a staff discussion if we felt it was an ongoing concern, and then that would be documented, the staff discussion. So I think it's, you know, yeah.
Well, I think that the question relates a bit, and I can understand, you know, wanting that specific direction and perhaps specific list of things. And I would say certainly amongst the demonstration initiative centers, they ended up more in this minimal documentation direction that Tracy's describing. Part of the foundation of getting there and figuring out what do we put in place and how is that kind of recognition that there's not necessarily a single recipe or single formula, but it's got several pieces, several tips that kind of help shape that. And part of that's focusing on how do we engage with mothers and fathers and children using the center rather than building mammoth files and kind of stepping back and asking questions about if we've developed a form or we're trying to decide, okay, what do we record during an observation, for example? Kind of stepping back and saying, well, who's at risk and how? Is this related to the control and threat of one adult parent towards another, where visitation is a setting that is going to be safer to have children coming back and forth? Why are we writing this down? Kind of why do we need this information? And Tracy provided that example of, well, one of the things we realized is that we needed an intake summary so that right on the front end, before any other information, it was clear, why is this family at the visitation center? What is the reason and the context for our intervention? Who benefits from what we write down? We kind of go back to that opening example where you have a lot of information about parenting relationships and interactions and one child hugging her father and bringing another son to visit and the children being happy about that, which is all very good. But the ways in which that information can be used out of the context of why is this family at the center? Well, here's someone who's been engaging in stalking behavior, has broken into his wife's residence, has had four domestic violence arrests in the last few months, has repeatedly violating restraining orders. That's a bigger, much bigger piece of the picture that goes missing unless the focus is looking at who's doing what to whom and with what impact. Now, Lana, this may or may not be helpful.
Yes.
We hope it's helpful, and we will have some additional tips. So, any other follow-up questions?
We're still just, yeah, that was our primary question is just knowing documentation or not.
And are you planning your center? Have you started providing services?
Yes, we've been in operation for about 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
There is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of us listening in.
Okay.
And it is to go over, as far as our documentation piece during supervised visits, what are the best practices?
Yeah. Like for the, we totally dropped, we don't put anything about what they did during the visit unless there was something that was going on that was of concern. So
you guys basically just, the best practice right now is parent time occurred, unless there is a rule violation.
Yeah, it's tricky because I think for it comes down to your philosophy and how you want to frame everything. So what we've worked really hard with the court to say that just because something didn't happen during a visit doesn't indicate anything regarding the safety outside the center. So we've worked really hard in our collaboration that the court should not be expecting assessments from us. That's our philosophical standing, that our assessments are it's too superficial of a setting. We've been very clear about our guidelines, and somebody really should be able to come for an hour and do fine with their kids. So for us, it's more about, okay, what's happening outside of that hour? When this guy is trying to, for instance, tell us all what's going on with her new partner every chance he gets, or he keeps coming consistently later and later, and or he's telling another guy in the waiting room to join his father's rights group or whatever. Those kinds of things are the things we're paying more attention to. And they don't always go in the documentation, but the staff is always aware of them. So, yeah, there isn't a simple answer. I think you just have to get really clear about what's the purpose of what you're writing.
Okay. Thank you.
Go ahead, Beth.
I was just going to say one of the helpful pieces to ground your discussion is to have a full staff discussion about why you exist in the first place.
Yeah.
What's your mission and the purpose of your organization to provide service? And that should be able to guide you in making decisions then about what you're paying attention to. And many programs who have been in operation before they became a supervised visitation grant program grantee may continue to provide services to other families who have other reasons for referral beyond domestic violence. So just to frame up our conversation, we are exclusively talking about families who come to supervised visitation for safety because of battering. And so if that's what you're talking about, then, you know, ask yourself, is this why we exist, provide safety? And that should provide the framework for your discussion about how you make this determination. We have another question, Jane. Do you want to take that right now, or do you want to?
I'm going to make one little comment. And maybe if we could, yeah, we'll take the question. One comment I had was, I think in addition to that discussion of role, I think this is where this guided reading of the files can also be very helpful, where you step back and you gather up some examples and you ask a series of questions. And this is something that I think Beth's right, we could provide a little guideline on how to do this. But you're stepping back and saying, okay, from this record, can we tell who needs protection? Can we tell whose safety is at stake? How does the file, the official story, account for or describe domestic violence? How does it account for or describe battering? And we've been using this term, and by battering we're meaning that ongoing coercion and control that's distinctive for its effort of one person to dominate and coerce, and also the lethality factor is a much more present in that kind of action and behavior. How does this file account for signs of continued abuse and victimization? So those examples that Tracy was giving about how do we make a record where we're getting these behavior of someone who's trying to really use the center as a means of continuing the battering. Are we paying attention to it? What does that look like? Should it look differently? And then where does this information go? Does it go anywhere? Who asks for it? Who gets it? What action gets taken? So you take that step back and sort of look at how does our official story of this family's experience at supervised visitation look? And is it accounting for equal regard for safety in the way that supervised visitation would be in domestic violence? So let's take our other question, and then we'll kind of go from that to kind of checking in on the rest of our foundations.
Okay, our next question comes from Clinton Cooper. Clinton, your line is open.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm speaking from CASA in Colorado Springs. When we're listening, or even when our team is talking, you know, it seems very vague and it's not a cookie cutter formula, in which I'm starting to understand. It's starting to make sense because I'm realizing it is the culture and the personality of the center combined with the culture and the personality of our families. And so when I'm listening in and I hear, you know, we're recording on the needs of safety, and then we're trying to look at the families that we're serving, we don't see a great amount of domestic violence and this need for safety. It's more of covert behavior of one parent against the other, or one parent trying to sabotage the other. And, you know, we're trying, as, you know, client coordinators, trying to discern, you know, who's right, who's wrong, and keeping the child focused. So if we're dealing in that role, what advice can you give us here we call it the visiting parent. If the visiting parent is being covert, or we're not hearing that the visiting parent is making statements and comments or probing information from our from the children, and yet, you know, it's being reported back from the child, it's being reported back to the bringing parent, and then it's brought to our attention. How do we discern those things and document those issues?
And are you speaking of families that have been specifically sent to your center by the court because of some concern about domestic violence?
Yes, ma'am. They've probably been ordered into our program because it's a restraining order, temporary restraining order, or the courts have said, you know, you need to make up your mind about this divorce case, and there may be some history of DV that's brought them in, and, or, you know, that's, you know, one of the foundational reasons has brought them in. But once they've been entered into our program, we're just trying to provide a service so one party can see their child.
And what kind of information is coming from your referral source about the reason? Are you getting police reports, if that's been part of it, or?
No, ma'am, we're not getting police reports. It's just a court order into our program, and then we'll ask the questions or do the survey about a history of domestic violence, and then we have Tessa, who's is like our domestic violence counselor, that if it's the bringing parent, and 9 times out of 10 it's a female, then they have her in their orientation dealing with the DV part of it.
Jane, can I just say something real quick?
Yeah, I was just going to...
Before my head explodes. I think that the main thing, if they're getting ordered there, I think remembering how you're being used. If there is a history of domestic violence and they're ordered to you because of that, you become a tool. And even the best of us, my whole staff, everybody comes from a DV background, and we are a tool of the batterer once we start. So thinking about how are you documenting, what's your documentation, what are your observations, what are they doing to benefit his ongoing battering? So we don't look at ourselves as trying to assess. We kind of just listen to their stories and do very in-depth intakes with each party and just asking them very simple questions. Tell me how you got here, what's been going on, what kinds of things you're worried about. And from those questions, you can get just we just get huge histories that isn't documented anywhere. We might not have any background information on a family other than they got ordered here. But they tell you a lot. Even the batterer will tell you a lot just in having a very sincere and open conversation about their history.
And I think that connects with one tip that I would put on the list, which is that how you develop that beginning relationship with orientation, beginning relationship with the mothers and fathers who are using the center. And I think it also connects actually with the number 7 on this list of foundation, which is establishing an ongoing dialogue on documentation. And that's staff talking with each other, it's staff talking with parents, it's the center talking with courts and its community partners and its referral sources about, is there more information that should be coming your way to provide a clearer picture of what is happening for a particular family who's using the center? And to keep that kind of discussion going about that framework again of what are we going to write down and who's going to use it and where is it going to go and how is it going to potentially be misused. And I will reassure you, this is kind of like the carnival presentation, that if you stay around till the end, there will be some more specific tips. I would like to, I think I'm looking at the clock here, and I'd like to just touch base on what we're suggesting as these foundations, you know, kind of foundations, and then you put the frame and fill out put the walls up, and you finish off the rooms, and we'll wrap up with some of that. But to really encourage centers to be stepping back again and, you know, thinking about how does our documentation relate to equal regard for safety? How can we use this detailed, guided reading of our files to ask questions about what we're doing and how we're doing it? There is no absolute single recipe or formula. As much as I know it's good to, we all kind of want that in many aspects of our work. Understanding your state's legal framework and having a support of legal advice and support is another piece of it, particularly in terms of looking at where does information go and how does it get used and what do we have to release to whom and under what circumstances. Another piece is looking at the impact of each documentation practice on our time and attention and resources. This is probably one of the things in reading lots and lots and lots of examples from lots of different centers that started to really strike me as being a piece of the picture. It takes a tremendous amount of work to write down all of these details about, like I said, kind of every hiccup. You know, walked through the door, a child took off her coat, went to greet her father with a hug, got the Candyland game out, sat down and played the game for 10 minutes. One of that really stuck with me was had an appropriate discussion about beef jerky. That's a lot of energy and attention that goes into writing all of that stuff down. And A, you can be so focused on doing that that you may be missing something that's more coercive or really is an example of battering behavior. certain looks, dynamics. It also can produce these voluminous records, pages and pages and pages, often handwritten. And usually if something's handwritten, it's hard to read, and the reality is people don't read it. And then this huge volume of material then, in some cases, being transferred to the courts, who are overwhelmed and can't make sense of it. So part of this foundation is looking at what are the implications of what we've structured on our time and attention and resources. Another piece, and this is the biggie, and again, it's the subject of its own audio conference training series, is stepping back and questioning our assumptions about neutral and objective. The writers of that example that we opened up with would have said that that was a very neutral and objective report. Striving for accuracy might be perhaps a more useful goal to being paying attention to what is accurate in the information that gets carried in the documentation. And then that final tip about establishing an ongoing dialogue. Now, before we wrap up, though, we want to kind of talk about some of these considerations for practice. Tracy had talked about kind of starting with that defining the role. Why are we here? What's our purpose as a supervised visitation program under this expectation, under these guiding principles that give a certain shape and meaning to things? The guiding principles, by the way, also have a practice section that addresses some aspects of documentation and some specific advice in that regard. And so that element of accountability, you know, what is our role? How does our role then shape what we do with respect to documentation? And here are some specific tips now for those of you who have been waiting for the do this. This is a more or less best practice. These are organized around kind of three key aspects of a center's work: orientation, observations, and then reports to the court. And they're drawn both from the work that we've done with the demonstration initiatives. They're also drawn from the guiding principles. They're also drawn from a forthcoming work from the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges, which is not available in published form yet, but will eventually be working its way to you. So as I go through these, kind of think back to this opening example that we started with, because I think you'll see where if these practice guidelines had been followed, that report would have looked quite a bit different. So under orientation, keep information collected to a minimum, meet separately with the parties, and talk with them instead of relying on the forms they hand in. Tracy made this point about how much understanding you can develop by having a conversation with someone. What are you most afraid of in bringing your children to the center? What's it been like for you going through this separation? Keeping separate files for each family member, keeping location and contact information in a separate file that is not accessible to parties. This is where people are living, phone numbers, where children are going to school, the kinds of little things that in the context of battering can be sometimes lethal information, but be used to, again, reinforce stalking, keeping in mind that in that context, person who is battering another is always looking for little bits of information to use to continue that ongoing coercion and control, which is often so ramped up after separation and particularly around children. And then also in orientation, to be really clear with people about the lack of confidentiality of information that's collected or observed. I think we sometimes offer more than really exists. Tracy, anything that you would add to this orientation list?
Well, yeah, I just think that when you're talking with the batterer, the same questions that you ask the survivor, he'll tell really interesting perspectives of it. So those conversations, I just can't emphasize enough that for me, that's more important than any other information I get, actually. So it's nice if somebody brings their court papers along with them, but I don't even read those until after I've had really deep discussions with both parties. So,
I'm just curious, because this has become kind of, in some respects, sort of a standard question oftentimes that interveners, for instance, police officers might ask, where they'll say, are you afraid that Mr. Brown will kill you?
I ask, tell me when was the time you were most afraid of him?
Mm-hmm.
And that often is not the time that there was an arrest.
Right.
It's often a totally different time, and almost always comes along with, in that moment I knew he would kill me. With the guys, the batterers, which are generally men, I'm sorry, I'm being gender biased here, but I will ask, tell me, if I can't get any information, I'll just ask, tell me what she's going to tell me. And I just get a whole story. And he'll elaborate on things. And they often will tell me more in that response than she told me. So I just think even asking the men, you know, what are you afraid of about using the program? How, you know, what's your concerns? The stories that come out, I'll figure out what the battering looks like. Was it more financial battering? Was it more sexual? What kinds of things were going on in this relationship that are the hot buttons?
Okay, now, do you write all of that down? What do you do with it?
I kind of summarize it. I come from the DV perspective of don't write anything down because it's dangerous. So I summarize what I can. I keep my handwritten notes until I've had a full staff debrief on it, and then those go. Those are shredded. But in the actual file, it'll be a summary, you know, that these are her safety concerns, these are his, but nothing that, you know, if he were going to get it or she was going to get his, it's not going to it shouldn't be anything new and surprising.
And it's linked back to that staff communication,
yep,
and review.
Absolutely, yep. And so then we have a lot of handwritten things here until we discuss it, and then we summarize what we think is relevant and get rid of the rest. But the whole staff needs to know, for instance, if she feels that he's following her out of here. If we didn't see him follow her out of here, we can't. There's nothing we can really do with that. But the staff needs to know that that's what she's afraid of right now and how we're going to respond to that.
Okay. I'm going to move on here to some considerations for practice under observations, kind of that day-to-day interaction, and certainly where many, 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 many pages have been written in many, many supervised visitation centers. So, considerations for practice: keep notes to a minimum. Put a bold cautionary note on all forms and reports regarding the limits of the information. Don't focus on parent-child interaction unless it's directly related to a safety concern or a critical incident. Require subpoenas before responding to records requests. Tracy, anything to add?
and make sure that it's a valid subpoena. We and
a valid subpoena, yes. Not just say you've been subpoenaed.
Yeah, the lawyers will often supposedly subpoena you, but it doesn't really count unless it's been. You should respond if you know that there's something, but that doesn't mean you go to court. And yeah, so that's all I can say about that.
And the final area of considerations for practice around reports to the court or referral source. And here this is a bit of repetition, but avoid including details about a client's parenting of children or custody and visitation arrangements unless it's directly related to the reason for the referral and safety of the children and adult victims. And include an explanation of why the family was referred to the center. Provide context for the information in the report. So kind of linking back to an example that Tracy gave earlier, they've started with this intake summary. Is that how you the term you use?
Yes.
It kind of sets forth right up front, here's why, here's what's going on. So, for example, the report that we started out with today, that would look a lot different. And one of the ways it would look different is it would reference that Mr. Brown was arrested X number of times in the last 6 months leading up to visitation for domestic violence charges. There have been 3 restraining order violations. Whatever kind of detail provides more of a picture about how to look at the information that's coming with it. Anything else, Tracy, around referral source?
Yep, I think, you know, we're a little radical in that we don't send anything to the court. Everything to us goes through the parties, and then they are free to do with it what they please. And that has spared us from being subpoenaed because we just give the information. We keep a family case file, and I'm not going to get into all that. But the point is, I think really sitting down with your staff and understanding who, you know, a lot of people just assume you have to give the court all this stuff. I think understanding who you're reporting to and why, and I think if you do automatically send things to the court, you know, we've also worked really closely with the court to say that if you get something from us, we don't write much, so when you get something, you should read it, because if, you know, they're not getting pages and pages and pages from us, so they do read it because they know we're minimalists, and so I think that collaboration, again, with the court is really important. And here we've just said, no, we've just tell the court, no, we're not giving you the information. But if you need it, the clients can request it and give it to you. So we just want everybody that we're working with to know what we're saying about them. So if you don't want to, you know, if you're keep, like, nothing in there should be a surprise. That still might increase everybody's risk because it's getting out. But there's nothing in there that we haven't told him, look, we're really concerned about this.
So kind of tying back to it all starts with that intake and orientation
explaining
to people,
this
is what we do, this is how we approach our documentation, this is what's available to you, this is how you can get it.
Yep,
there's
exactly.
Not going to be any surprise here if you ask for this.
Yeah. And we are very upfront about we're here because there's been allegations of safety concerns. So we're not here to assess whether those things are true or not. We're just going to always err on the side of caution, and we want you to know that. And if we are making a mistake, please bring it to our attention. We will discuss it thoroughly. We do make mistakes, but we're going to always make the mistakes on the side of safety. So I think just being transparent about what we're doing helps a lot. And we have a rule here. If you can't say why you have a rule, then you shouldn't have the rule.
That's a good tip. And I see we are a little over our time.
We are. So I want to be respectful of people's time and try to wrap up here. Is there one more parting comment that you want to make, Jane, before I do our final wrap-up?
Well, one thing I'll mention is I think, Beth, if I provide you with this list of considerations for practice, can you email that to participants?
Yes, we'll post it on our website.
Yep.
and people can download it.
Okay, so
and as the series continues, if there are additional practice considerations, I'll take responsibility to collect all of those and we'll put them in one spot for you.
Right, and I realized we are just kind of, we've scratched the surface here. This is such a huge part of figuring out how a visitation center is going to do its work. And we hope we've given you some ideas for setting a foundation and some more specific approaches. And just keep up the hard work and keep coming back to these different points where you have an opportunity to talk with people like Tracy and to take advantage of the technical assistance that's out there.
Yep. And also to remember that visitation centers shouldn't be doing this alone or feeling like they're alone in this process. I was very pleased when I was receiving all the registrations for this series that we had an awful lot of collaborative partners registering for this series, which is really fantastic to see. But what it also tells me is that each of you listening have a great opportunity to pull all of your collaborative partners together and have a conversation about what you can do with this 75-minute conversation and how you can turn this into a bigger piece of your ongoing exploration and work together. And if you find in your exploration that you want additional assistance, Praxis is here to provide that technical assistance. We can link you with other technical assistance providers as well. So please don't hesitate to contact us, but please don't stop your conversation. 75 minutes is not nearly long enough, but hopefully does the trick to start your conversation. So please feel free to contact us if you need additional support. I want to thank Jane and Tracy for taking the time to be with us today and all of you who participated on the call. We really appreciate it. I'm going to be sending out an online survey link shortly today. Shortly after today's call, so please feel free to fill that out and send it in. Please remember to look on our website. We have a whole variety of events and training coming up. Registration is filling up rather quickly for our in-person events. Our December roundtable is full to capacity. Our January roundtable is near capacity, and our March Institute is filling up fast. So if you have intentions of attending those, please register very, very quickly before you don't have that opportunity anymore. Please remember to join us next week. We will explore confidentiality. Same time, same channel for all of you. I also wanted to say that on our Rural TA homepage on Praxis's website, there is a recording under event recordings that discerns recognizing and understanding battering. We had mentioned earlier in this conversation that it's very important to know what we're talking about, and that's a very good recording. It's a 75-minute recording on how to talk about and recognize and understanding the difference between domestic violence and battering. So that would help ground some local conversations, I'm sure. And feel free to email me anytime you want at beth@praxisinternational.org. And the last final comment I have is I received an email from Kimberly and those folks joining her from Alaska. So if you wouldn't mind staying on the line, I can quickly get your questions answered that you have pending there. So to all of you, thanks and have a great day. And this concludes our call for the day.